Okay, the Muppets are back. Their first feature film in over a decade opens this week.
It's time to play the music. It's time to light the lights.
The movie stars Jason Segel, Amy Adams, and a cast of thousands, some of whom are Muppets, acting like movie stars.
There's only one Miss Piggy.
Only a few journalists were permitted on the set during filming, and one of them was NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg, who met some of the puppeteers who make the Muppets move.
We visited the Muppets, that's the name of the movie, last winter on a huge soundstage at Universal Studios in Burbank, California. Picking our way through tables and cameras and stuff that would make Oscar's trash can look tidy, we found the Muppet diva getting ready for her close-up.
I am so easy. I don't have any demands at all. Merely chocolate in my dressing room, flowers in my trailer. Of course, the trailer has to be a semi.
Since their last big screen encounter, Muppets in Space, in 1999, the Muppets each went their separate ways. But when they learned that their old Muppet Theater in Los Angeles is being torn down so an oil tycoon can drill underneath, they reunite to save it. How? They hold a telethon.
We have Muppets standing by to take your calls.
Yes, we are. Good evening, everyone.
Could I have a large pizza with ham and...
Yes, and boy, do we have a wonderful show.
The movie's Muppet Theater was assembled on a set built for the 1925 silent film Phantom of the Opera. That old stage set, draped with dusty red velvet swags, still looks phantom-ridden.
I'll be looking for Kevin.
Oh, and Sweetum, so we need Matt.
In a cramped balcony box, some Muppets crowd together to shoot a scene. First, puppeteer Matt Vogel has a problem.
I have a place where I can stick my hand through here if I wanted to, and I don't want you to see it on camera.
Muppet Captain Bill Beretta races to the rescue.
I'll have to think about this all day now.
You would think it was Olivier doing Hamlet, but no. Bill Beretta makes decisions like this every other second. It's not that easy being Muppet Captain. Beretta also performs some Muppets. He took on a few characters enacted by the late Muppet creator Jim Henson. Characters like the Swedish chef, Ralph the dog, Dr. Teeth. And Bill Beretta performs some newer Muppets like Pepe, a little Spanish-speaking shrimp.
He's not a shrimp, please. He's a king prawn, okay? It's a big difference. The size is what matters, okay?
Okay. Pepe's performer Bill Beretta says his wife's Spanish aunt was the inspiration.
She had this great way of talking to people. She only spoke in statements. You know, she would say, "This is a black shirt, okay?" Yeah, okay.
Come on, Bill, we go to the mall, okay?
That's what she said all the time. It was okay at the end of everything. So
during a brainstorming session for a 1996 Muppet TV show, Beretta found himself describing his aunt-in-law.
And she was a little bit selfish in a way, and I said, you know, she's very fine, but a little shellfish. And I said, shellfish, by mistake. And one of the writer-directors said, wait a minute, okay, maybe it's a lobster, or it's a crab, or a shrimp. And, oh, maybe a shrimp. No, wait, it's a king prawn, because maybe he has a problem with size.
I love this. It takes a village to make a prawn.
Absolutely.
Totally collaborative.
And I think that was something that Jim created.
Yeah.
That was always the way it was. Just glad to be a part of that process.
Yeah, but how did the aunt-in-law feel? She was not offended?
No, she loved it.
She said, it is okay, okay.
Everybody's making their way in.
Some special guest stars show up to do cameo roles in the telethon scene, helping raise money to save the Muppet Theater. So, also jammed into that small balcony box, Whoopi Goldberg, James Carville, Judd Hirsch, Neil Patrick Harris. The director yells,
"Rolling!"
And the actors start ad-libbing with one another and the Muppets. But hand puppets can't see the stars or anybody or thing for that matter. Movie magic, however, helps the puppeteers be invisible. Muppet Captain Bill Beretta explains.
We have monitors in specific places so that the puppeteers are able to see what they're doing and at the same time see what the other person is doing and at the same time moment-to-moment reacting as an actor would do. So it's all those things that come together at once.
Principal-wise, they need the front row.
The puppeteers have to pretzel themselves out of camera range. They sit, they squat, they belly down under tables, ledges. Sometimes the sets are raised 4 feet off the ground for easier Muppet maneuvering. That's the inside work with lots of lifting. Outside work is even trickier. For a big song and dance number, Hollywood Boulevard was shut down for 2 days. Dancers, human actors, and Muppets all performed in the real world.
We have to be down on the ground with little rolly chairs and straining and trying to get your head down below the shot, and it's much more difficult to be out in the real world.
Here we go.
James Bobin is the movie's director.
Cut. Great, good. Got that.
It's his first film, and he's a total newbie to the Muppets.
No Muppet training whatsoever, as you can probably tell.
So Bobin relies heavily on Muppet veterans like Bill Beretta.
So whenever I have an idea, I say, Bill, is that possible? And he tells me yes or no. Normally he says yes, which is good for me. But there are obviously limitations in shooting puppets. Door handles are a nightmare, always the wrong height. Windowsills, a no-no, very difficult to get around windowsills. Generally, they're hand puppets, so they come from underneath. They often have no legs. Shh, whisper it quietly, don't tell people that.
Now, you would think in this age of computer-generated special effects, they could make some Muppet legs. But James Bobin says no.
This is very much a puppet festival, and it's all about, you know, felt and fur and seeing that for real, not computer graphics.
And won't all the Muppets lovers out there be glad about that?
We are the Muppets.
Hello.
Hello.
Mimi.
Hello.
The Muppets, the movie, opens the day before Thanksgiving.
Boom.
I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
Boom. Boom. Boom.
Kermit, has it gotten any easier being green?
You know it has. I think it has gotten easier. I think people are more accepting of green. I know I myself went to a Being Green support group. And it's helped quite a lot. But can I say something directly to your listeners? If any of you wake up in the morning and you find yourself green, I would suggest you see a doctor.
Green's the color of spring. Yeah, green is cool and friendly life.
It's Muppet Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
Like a mountain, important like a river, a tall like a
those needing a break from all the football excitement may pull out the board games today. Board games, of course, are among the oldest forms of entertainment, but there is room for innovation, as NPR's Travis Larchuk reports.
Okay, so I brought in a bunch of board games from home, and no matter what board game you're talking about, you know, Scrabble, Monopoly, Cranium, they all actually have something in common, and it's not quite so obvious. But this guy figured it out.
My name is Rob Davio, and I'm a board game designer.
He works for Hasbro, and a few years ago, he was playtesting a new version of Clue. You know Clue, Colonel Mustard in the study with the revolver. So he's playing this game over and over again, and just by chance, the same character kept coming up as the killer.
I mentioned something like, oh man, I don't know why they keep inviting Mustard back. He's killed 3 people in a row. And it made me sort of like pause for a moment and think, wow, there's something there. Why do board games always start over? They have no memory. It's like Groundhog's Day. And what if there was a way to make a board game sort of remember one game to the next so it became an ongoing narrative rather than a series of isolated events?
Now, video games already do this. We take that for granted. But for board games, this is uncharted territory. So Rob Davio decided to take this concept and apply it to another Hasbro game, Risk, which I have an early copy of right here. And the game board is a map of the world, and each player gets these little plastic armies and tries to kill the other player's little plastic armies by rolling dice. So Rob Davio's new version is called Risk Legacy, and I took that game to a friend's house to test it out.
Oh, double sixes.
Yeah.
This is a bloody battle.
What makes this different from the old Risk is that decisions you make change the game permanently. So, for example, my friend Sean gets to build a city in Africa, and he gets to name it whatever he wants. So, he peels off a sticker, sticks it to the game board, and writes on it with permanent marker.
What are you going to name it?
Bakersfield, Ethiopia.
So in every game after this one, whoever controls Bakersfield, Ethiopia gets a bonus. Forever.
The sticker doesn't come up. I mean, you could rip it up, but you'd ruin both the sticker and the board.
At other times, you do destroy parts of the game. You rip open secret envelopes, tear up game cards, and throw them away. Now, there are folks out there who love board games. They treasure them. They want to preserve them. They even have a website, BoardGameGeek.com. And after Risk Legacy was announced, the discussion was heated. Some thought the idea was genius. Others, like Brad Minnig, were cautiously intrigued.
I'm very careful with my games, so it's going to be hard for me to rip cards in half.
And some were strongly against. Walter O'Hara posted a comment saying,
something to the effect of that it was a cynical money grab by Hasbro, and do they think we're total morons?
The game can't be reset, so if you want to start fresh, you need to buy a new copy. And this game costs more than $50. Designer Rob Davio has heard this criticism before.
If this was a real plan to get people to buy more board games, it probably wouldn't be in a Risk game that's being sold in the hobby markets. This was really start to finish just a design project of how to play around with the assumptions of what a board game should and shouldn't be.
Risk Legacy will be in specialty game stores and online just in time to be ripped up and written over during the holidays. Travis Larchuk, NPR News.
And I think, Howard, that's a great place to end the segment and segue into this month's episode of Science Diction. What have you got for us this month, Howard?
Well, the word is stethoscope.
Stethoscope.
Yes. Huh. And, you know, doctors have been listening to patients' breath sounds since at least 1500 BC, but it really wasn't until the early 19th century that a French physician named René Laennec systematically investigated the sounds that we make when we breathe and also of our heartbeat. And, you know, the time-honored way of doing that was literally to place your ear on a patient's chest. And Laennec didn't like that. For one, if he had an obese patient, it was very hard to hear through all that fat. And also, you know, he was treating the great unwashed, literally, and they had poor hygiene and sometimes they were lice-ridden, and that sort of disgusted him. So he came up with this invention, the stethoscope, which he was also a Greek scholar, and he took that name from two Greek roots, stethos, which means chest, and scopen, which means to look at or to observe.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Plato, talking with Howard Markel, author of An Anatomy of Addiction. The early stethoscope didn't look much like the one we have today, did it?
Not at all. It was a hollow tube made out of cedar or ebony. And it was a really charming story of how that came to be. It was in 1816, he was late to see a patient, a woman with heart disease, and he was taking a shortcut through the courtyard of the Louvre. And he saw some boys playing on a pile of timber. And two boys were playing with a long plank or a log, and one was taking a pin or a nail and scratching it on one end, and the other boy could hear it all the way on the other end, you know, as sound will travel through a solid body. And he thought, wow, that's a great idea. And then he went to see his patient, and he asked for some paper, and he rolled it up into a cylinder. And he put it against this woman's chest, and he was absolutely amazed at how he could hear the heart in a way that he had never been able to hear before.
Wow. But even if they could hear, you know, something rattling around in the chest, in those days, was there anything that you could really do about it?
Well, back then, diagnosis was more important than treatment. They didn't have a lot of treatment. But what was really remarkable about Laennec is that he figured out so many things about diseases of the chest, you know, things like tuberculosis or emphysema, and also of heart disease, whether they were heart murmurs or other problems of the heart, so that doctors could accurately diagnose these. And he experimented with a series of tubes, hollow tubes. It's about a foot to a foot and a half long. And he wrote a textbook called On the Practice of Auscultation. Now, auscultation comes from the Latin auscultare, which means to listen. So it's on the practice of listening. It was published in 1819. It was a bargain at 13 francs because you also got a stethoscope with it.
Wow.
But it took a while for it to catch on. The book had to be translated in different languages. And finally, it became the iconic symbol. And by about 1851, the binaural stethoscope, what's very familiar to people today with the two ear prongs and the tubes began to develop, and that became the stethoscope as we know it.
Yeah, is the stethoscope as we know it becoming obsolete? You know, we have all this imaging technology.
Sadly, yes. I still know how to use my stethoscope, and I remember – avidly listening to tapes of heart sounds and breath sounds so that I could learn them on real patients. And it is sad. With all our wonderful, you know, non-invasive imaging techniques, you know, we can learn more and more about a patient without ever being in the room. And that's kind of sad because as that distance has grown, we've lost something. And I think maybe we ought to hang on to our stethoscopes a little bit longer to remind that one of the principal aspects of being a doctor is listening to our patient.
All right, Howard, thank you very much.
Well, thank you and happy Thanksgiving.
You too. Howard Markell is a professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor and director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. That's about all the time we have for this hour. We would like you to stay with us, but we don't have any more time. Greg Smith composed our theme music. It would help today from NPR librarian Keem Molesky. And if you missed any part of this program, you can go to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast, audio and video, or go to our website at sciencefriday.com. And you can take Sci-Fi along with you on your iPhone and your Android apps. You can download them there. And you can continue our week-long discussion on Twitter at Sci-Fi, at SCIFRI. Well, we'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
We're now going to take you on a bit of a detective story. First, we need a gumshoe, preferably from a group with a cool name.
I'm Dave Palmer. I work for The Speak.
Next, we need an appropriate theme song as we lay out the story. Long before MTV brought music videos into our living rooms, early pioneers had been setting up cameras and recording performances. But a lot of these have been lost or forgotten. That's where Dave Palmer and The Speak come in.
We're a company that seeks classic music videos from the 50s, 60s, and 70s and sells them through iTunes.
And they're very picky about what counts as a music video.
It's not just music set to a background. It is a performance, sometimes with the artist singing, sometimes with dancers. But the objective is that this is to promote and sell that performance in the first place.
This week, The Speak released what they believe is the holy grail of the genre, something they stumbled across completely by accident, the first music video.
Hello, baby! Yeah, this is the Big Bopper speaking.
It has all the components of a modern video, albeit filmed 23 years before MTV came along. It's a painted setting, hand-painted in black and white. At the start of Chantilly Lace, someone hands him a phone which he puts to his ear. So there's props there, basic setting, but they are the components of today's modern music video.
Chantilly lace and a pretty face and a ponytail hanging down.
Chantilly lace was shot in 1958, after hours in a supper club in Texas, just months before the Big Bopper was killed along with Buddy Holly and Ritchie Valens in a plane crash. Still have doubts this is the first music video? This is where J.P. Richardson Jr. comes in. He's the son of the Big Bopper, and after a chance meeting with a friend of his father...
She brought me these boxes, and one of these boxes was a copy of a magazine article from England, a disc magazine, and the headline read, Records Will Be Filmed.
It was a quote from the Big Bopper published just 10 or so days before that plane crash.
I tell people, had my father lived, you'd have had Bopper vision 20 years before you had MTV.
And if you wanted more proof of how visionary the Big Bopper was, in the same article, he also predicted there would be machines that recorded television programs so people could watch them when they wanted to, long before the VCR or DVR or even the term music video was coined. You can see the Big Bopper videos at thespeak.com or at bigboppermusic.com.
Ain't another in a world like a big-eyed girl to make me act so funny, make me spend my money, make me feel real loose like a long-necked goose and like a girl. Oh, baby, that's what I like!
This is NPR News.